Techonomics on KGO 810. Welcome to this week's Techonomics. We start this week with an idea of turning coal miners into computer coders. Not every person who learns to code is going to create Facebook or a Google-like algorithm. There are plenty of regular workday coding gigs out there. With more to come, host Jason Middleton talks with two sides of the coding issue about the best way to grow jobs for Americans, jobs that were largely eliminated because of so-called advancements from Silicon Valley. Then we jump into the future tripping machine. Just what do hotel rooms of the future look and feel like? How far past turndown service will hotels go to get guests to stay with them? Customization and personalization in the hospitality industry is coming up. And finally, Periscope, the live stream video company, is trying to be best of breed in a very competitive space. Can Periscope help pull Twitter out of its tailspin? All that and a little more on this week's Techonomics, starting now on KGO 810.
You must be raving mad.
We're on the air.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Techonomics. I am your host, Jason Middleton. Let's start the show in the middle, as in the middle class. Now, it's natural to feel economically nostalgic, but the fact is, America was booming when it had a bulging middle class. And with the manufacturing jobs disappearing over the past several decades, onshoring those jobs will be trickier than executive actions from the White House or rhetoric on Capitol Hill. It will take innovation, incentive, and planning, and that means policy on a socially universal stage. No small feat, of course, but still doable.
We've actually had these shifts, and the only time we've got through them reasonably well is when there was, you know, a great collective push on the part of society to say, we are going to manage this transition.
One chunk of middle-class work could come from the disruptors themselves, computer coding. Not everyone who learns computer coding needs to invent a new sector-busting technology. Maybe they just need to keep website logins working or ATMs from jamming. We start the conversation with a longtime tech journalist and featured columnist at Wired magazine. And we talk about a middle-class pivot from assembly lines to algorithms.
My name is Clive Thompson, and I am a columnist for Wired.
Yeah, and that's why we're calling you this week, Clive, and thank you for the time. I'm looking at Code is King, a reboot for blue-collar jobs. Why don't you, in your voice, give me the graph, the nut graph, if you will.
In this column, what I was trying to do was to point out that computer code is becoming a big industry, right? We all know this is an area where a lot of people are getting employed, but we tend to only hear about the very famous kind of young hotshot coders that go to Silicon Valley and they do a startup and, you know, it makes, you know, millions and millions of dollars, makes them insanely rich. That's the paradigm we hear. And so over and over again, I think people in pop culture or in mainstream culture think of coding as this thing that only real wizards do, and you have to be like an absolute genius at it, you know, otherwise why try to learn any code or anything like that?
Right.
And the truth of it is, though, and I knew this from, you know, years of covering the software industry, is that there's a whole range of code that needs to be written. And a lot of it is much more like, it's almost more akin to blue collar work, right? It's like, you know, we have a bank website here and we need someone just to make sure the JavaScript is updated and works well so people can log in. And it's a well-paying job. It's an interesting job. It requires, you know, like cool engineering problem solving. But, you know, you don't have to be, you know, the sort of 23-year-old guy in a hoodie who's, you know, banking his whole life on some crazy risk-taking thing. This is much more like exactly the type of sort of very solid middle-class job that people in the last election season were worried was vanishing, right? So I wanted to basically call attention to the fact that this much larger category of code is something we should be thinking a lot about, because if that's sort of the types of jobs, and there's a lot of them that are currently unfilled that we need to fill, then it changes a little bit the way we think of how to train people to get those jobs.
Potentially like a replacement for the manufacturing middle class? Is it like a Johnny Punch Clock, lunch pail, yeah, 9 to 5, going to go code for a little while kind of thing? I mean, because if so, you're, yeah, right. You've really touched on something very, very important as we pivot towards AI and VR and everything else.
Whether it can replace all the factory jobs that are gone, you know, probably not. You know, you still need to think of new forms of manufacturing that are going to happen. And, you know, people in the renewables industry are working very hard at that, right? Guys like Elon Musk are hiring thousands and thousands of people,
right,
to staff up his factories. But there is projected by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, the official folks that sit around looking at these stats, they predict hundreds and hundreds of thousands, well over a million of these jobs that are going to be needed in the next 10 or 15 years. So that's a good chunk of employment that pays really well. Like, we're talking about average salaries that are, you know, $70,000 to $80,000 a year, more than double the national average.
Right.
And, you know, that if you're making that sort of money in any state, if you're not living in one of the sort of five incredibly expensive cities, you know, you're doing incredibly, you're doing very well, let me say.
And I'll toss in on top of that, too. You're not having to commute every day because you can code from just about anywhere. So you're saving some cost there, too, and time.
The flexibility of it as a work style is also good because you're right. The work can and often is done remotely. I mean, obviously people like to go to offices because it, you know, gets them out of their pajamas and into a work mode. But I talk to tons and tons of programmers who hold very senior jobs in companies where they work remotely, where they are all over the place, where they come in, you know, once, maybe twice a week for the meetings and stuff. So it has a lifestyle quality that is really appealing. To me, it's a very interesting area where I think policymakers should be looking at this, because one of the problems right now is, you know, there aren't as many ways to on-ramp onto that job as we might like. You know, there, you could go and get a computer science degree at a university. The problems there is that it can be very expensive. It's 4 years long. It's a lot of debt. It's not necessarily training you in the types of work skills. Like, you'd learn a lot of great theoretical stuff about kind of how algorithms work, but you won't necessarily learn some of the really practical skills. So in some respects, maybe what we need more is a scaling up of, like, good old-fashioned classical vocational training, like at very affordable community colleges that are aimed at, all right, we're going to produce people who can walk in and do be really good entry-level workers at these companies that need someone, you know, to manage the back-end database for this website, you know, someone that needs to do front-end design to make the front-end of a website look good. This could be a really terrific thing that brings a lot of people into the middle class and upper middle class.
The illustration with the with your article in Wired, I know you don't do the illustrations. You probably don't even write the headlines for it. You're the body. You're the copy.
That's true, yes.
But there are a couple of guys with hard hats and miners' lights on, and they're breaking through the coal mine wall, and they're looking at a row of cubicles and coding things. And that's not terribly far off, because you did hit right there. You, in your previous answer, the retraining expectations of this are a two-year degree community college kind of thing, and then you can be better positioned and be better accepted in a different industry, and because you've proven your worth. Before we let you go, I want to jump off into one more area of the soulless nature of Silicon Valley. On this show, we've talked about it a few times. When logging companies clear-cut a forest, they are legally required to replant trees. Silicon Valley sees no compunction to do such a thing. Is there some kind of larger aspect to this that you saw while you were reporting for this one?
The problems that Silicon Valley causes for the economy at large are pretty simple, which is that computers are really good at making things efficient, at doing repetitive tasks, you know, at taking something that was hard to do because it was spread out over a big geographical area and making it centralized, right? And that has a lot of really great spillover effects for the rest of our lives as citizens, as consumers, as people who want to get things done. Now, the downside is you make things more efficient. Generally, you don't need as many workers. This is just kind of the way it works. What is Silicon Valley's responsibility to the fact that they are one of the greatest automators and introducers of efficiency into labor? You know, I would actually suggest that in one sense, they don't have that much responsibility. Because if you're going to have a capitalist economy and you're going to tell people to go out there and make lots of money with their companies, and that's going to be one of their prime things, and we're going to assume or hope that good things come out of that, they're going to wreck other things. You know, they're going to outcompete others. They're going to put other people out of business. And there's going to be these big systemic changes in labor. The only way that a society can really cope with big, big changes like that when new industries rise and fall is at the level of collective government action, right? You know, saying, okay, there are some winners and there are some losers here. We are going to have to level the playing field a little bit, either by, you know, offering more retraining, by offering subsidies to industries as they off-ramp and shrink, by offering everything from relocation cost to people so they can get out of one area where the town is now dead, you know, and it's never coming back, to a place where there actually is work. Over and over again through history, we've actually had these shifts. And the only time we've got through them reasonably well is when there was you know, a great collective push on the part of society to say, we are going to manage this transition, you know, and it involves everything from tax policy, you know, how you sort of, you know, help subsidize people who are going through a rocky transition, to education policy, to how are you going to make it possible to educate people to move into these new areas, to industrial policy, right? You know, how are you going to use the government's purchasing power to get things done to help kickstart industries? You know, if you, for example, you know, if you wanted to have much more manufacturing, well, one area where it's really necessary is in climate adaptation and in clean energy, right? You know, if you, you know, right now, all these coastal cities are getting flooded more and more and more, and it's going to require a massive amount of good old-fashioned physical labor to get up there and create the sort of adaptation techniques ranging from, you know, better drainage systems to dikes to replanting types of scrub grass that soak up water. I mean, this is stuff that, like, if the government was really serious about putting people to work and improving the quality of the infrastructure, they can do. So I actually think that it's certainly unsettling when you see how Silicon Valley can flip a switch and just destroy an industry overnight.
I've had Vivek Wadhwa on recently. I've had Guy Kawasaki on recently. And now you and you're, and I like to get contrary opinions, and you have a different take on things, but I have to say that we're all kind of walking in the same direction.
Absolutely.
Clive, this has been a wonderful talk. Thank you so much for your time today. Let's check in maybe Q1 next year to see how things are moving.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Thanks for having me on.
That was Clive Thompson, a columnist and tech journalist at Wired Magazine, among others. There's a link to his column at facebook.com/techonomicsradio. I've also tweeted a link at KGO Jason. Coming up after this short break, part two of Cracking the Code, we have the leader of an educational initiative called Code 10, as in Code Tennessee.
And we had problems with people who didn't understand a kind of Salesforce backend. You know, there was essentially people having enough comprehensive knowledge to manage a very simple database. We're not even talking about coding.
I'm Jason Middleton. This is Techonomics. Please come on back.